We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today to the executive director of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, Sarah Weintraub, by phone. Sarah, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And we're talking to you, where is it, San Francisco, Oakland, where exactly are you?
We are in Oakland, California. Yes, mailing address is in Berkeley.
Now, you have spent 7 years in dangerous Colombia working for peace. You've spent time in a Zen monastery. You grew up as a Buddhist, second-generation American Buddhist, and now you're the executive director of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and you're not even 30 yet. Is that right?
That's right. I'm 29.
Tell us about growing up Buddhist in San Francisco.
Yeah, well, my parents are both Zen priests and Zen teachers at the San Francisco Zen Center, which is a pretty large American Zen community, and the Zen Center has three locations, one in San Francisco and two more rural locations, and various ways that people participate. Some people come, you know, over the weekend as kind of like going to church. Other people live there residentially. There's some more monastic training at one of the rural centers called Tassajara, and various ways of being a part of it. And my parents were deeply a part of the Zen Center community from their early 20s and had me in their early 30s, and I grew up also a part of that community. We had our own house and our own kind of, you know, separate family life within the community, within a community of trusted adults and other practitioners.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I do. I have a younger brother who's 5 years younger, and I have an older half-brother.
And have they followed in the Buddhist tradition, or have they made other choices?
You know, they haven't specifically followed in the Buddhist tradition. I think both of them lead sort of undercover Buddhist lives, perhaps without even knowing it. Neither of them have trained or practiced Buddhism specifically.
But it was a choice for you. You had the freedom from your parents to follow your own path.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I grew up as part of that community, but there's not really in that community any sort of expectation or pressure on the children to participate in any way. My parents have said they felt like choosing to practice, you know, to sit meditation is an adult decision. Which makes sense to me, kind of like how can you make someone meditate? You can make someone sit still and be quiet. But so I feel like I was exposed to the teachings and to the kind of way of life just very much by osmosis through my childhood, but wasn't actually interested in practicing until much later.
So when did you make the choice to yourself practice Buddhism?
Yeah, so I had I was 25 years old. I had been living in Colombia for 3 years at that point, and I left, and I decided to spend the summer at the Tassajara Zen Mountain Monastery, which is one of the outposts of the San Francisco Zen Center, and very rural in the mountains in central California. And really, I went there with the idea of I wanted to rest and be safe and be in this beautiful place in the mountains that was one of my homes.
Sarah, excuse me for interrupting, but we're getting a bad telephone signal, and I'm going to have our engineer call you back. So if you would hang up, and she will call you, our engineer, Kyle Crow, will give you a call. We'll see if we can get a better connection because it's breaking up, and it'll be easier if we get a good line.
Okay.
All right, thank you. We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Sarah Weintraub, that's Weintraub, in Oakland. And usually we have good telephone connections, but at the moment we're having a little difficulty. technically, so we're going to try to solve that, and we'll be back on the air as soon as we have a better line. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, and I might explain to regular listeners that, yes, I do have a summer cold, and so my voice has dropped about another half an octave, and it was low enough already. So we not only have me sounding different, so we're having difficulty with the phone line. So we're going to try to solve at least one of those problems. Let me tell listeners who's coming up on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead. Next week we'll be talking with Maureen Holtz, who is one of two authors of a new book called Robert Allerton, The Private Man, The Private Gifts. That'll be it's a biography of the very interesting philanthropist, collector of art, Robert Allerton. That'll be next week, July 18. But I understand we have a good connection now with our guest, Sarah Weintraub. Let's find out. Sarah, are you there?
I'm here. How does that sound?
Oh, much better.
Okay, great.
Great. Wonderful. That's great. Well, you were telling us about your choice at age 25. I think you said you'd been in Columbia 3 years. And you might tell us what took you there.
What took me to Columbia?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or is that a longer story? We should hear the rest of
it. That's a longer story, but I could try to give the brief version.
Okay.
Yeah. I had studied and lived in Latin America for a number of years, particularly in Central America, and particularly studying the kind of post-war life in Central America, Nicaragua particularly. And from there, I found out about a strategy of solidarity called accompaniment, in which foreigners are present with threatened human rights defenders and peace workers in order to protect them. And I was really drawn to that strategy of solidarity and kind of non-interventionist work. And it's going on in Colombia and has been very effective in Colombia. So I wanted to work in that strategy, and I already spoke Spanish and had that Latin America background. So it felt very natural. And my commitment in Colombia was for a year, and then I extended it, and it's become a central part of my life. I lived in Colombia for 3 years full time, and then for the past 4 years, I've continued to be involved in Colombia human rights and peace work, but not living there, but going back for a few months each year, doing various creative and political projects, and also during that time lived at the San Francisco Zen Center, mostly at the Tasajara Zen Mountain Monastery. So I went to Tasajara with the idea of resting and being in this safe, beautiful place that felt like home to me. And part of the commitment for living at Tasajara as a Zen student is to participate in the work there, the work practice, and also the meditation practice and attend the teachings and et cetera. So it was really over about a few months when I was living at Tasajara that I actually started to be interested in the Buddhist aspect of it. It was really the place itself that drew me. And then I got very involved and really came to appreciate the Buddhist practice that was going on there.
With your background growing up in the San Francisco Zen Buddhist community, did you feel rather lonely in Colombia? There certainly are not probably very many Buddhists there.
No, not particularly. I don't think, I didn't really think of my Buddhist background as a big part of my identity. I had focused a lot in other areas, and I found a lot of people to share those other areas with me in Colombia, through the activist work I was doing, and I made good friends who loved to salsa dance and, had a pretty full life when I was there. And then later, after I had been living at Zen Center as an adult, when I went back to Colombia, I connected with some Colombian Buddhists also.
When you went to Colombia, were you with a particular organization?
I was. I was with a wonderful program through the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is a very old pacifist organization, interfaith pacifist organization.
Yes, the oldest international peace organization in the world.
Yes, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so Fellowship of Reconciliation runs a program called the Columbia Peace Presence, and I kind of got in on the ground level. The project was just starting up at the time, so I was very involved with it and continue to be involved and continue as a kind of advisor to that project.
for listeners, this program is being broadcast live online as well as over the air at will.illinois.edu. And if you go there, you can get part of this program. If you missed it, it'll be archived there for later. And also, previous interviews are there. For example, one with the U.S. Director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation that was just mentioned, Mark Johnson. If you put his name in the search engine, you'll find that interview if you'd like to learn more about FOR. But getting back to Sarah Weintraub, who's the director of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, your organization is one of many religious groups that's part of the overall Fellowship of Reconciliation. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
The short answer.
And when you were involved in that FOR program in Colombia, did you even know the Buddhist Peace Fellowship existed?
I did. You know, there's a kind of historic connection between the San Francisco Zen Center and the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. So I kind of knew of the organization and actually knew some of the people who worked in the organization through, like, friends of my parents. And my mom was actually on the board of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship many, many, many years ago, probably about 20 years ago, for a brief time. So, yeah, so I knew it existed, but I didn't know much about what BPS, the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, did.
We're going to talk about some of the activities. There's a very long list. I've been to your website, which which incidentally is bpf.org. B as in Buddhist, P as in Peace, F as in Fellowship.org. And you can find there many of the programs that they're involved with. But I want to, of course, ask Sarah about them. But let me open the telephone lines up. This is a live call-in show. And if you're listening online or if you're listening over the air, you, of course, may call and make a comment or a question for our guest. If you're listening online and it's a long-distance call to Illinois, punch in 1-800-222-9455. If it's a local call within the 217 area code, punch in 333-9455. So, long distance, 1-800-222-WILL. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Sarah, tell us a little bit about what the Buddhist Peace Fellowship does.
Yeah, so the kind of overarching description of what we do is that we work together for peace and justice from a perspective of interconnectedness. And in kind of Buddhist terms, it's bringing together wisdom and compassion, and that those meet together in the deep bow of socially engaged Buddhist action.
Now, people are surprised to hear Buddhists who want to focus on the moment, being in the moment, meditation, being activists. Why do you see them connected?
You know, to me, it feels like, it really feels like one thing. It feels like as part of our Buddhist practice, we study and cultivate wisdom, and we look around and we study ourselves and we study what's going on within our own being through meditation and other practices, and we also are aware of the world and the conditions that make us who we are and bring our being into being and bring other situations into being, and very naturally from that kind of wisdom study and then the meeting with the Buddhist value of compassion comes a kind of natural extension into action, that we see what's going on and we see where we can intervene or where we can be a part of things or where we can support something positive or prevent something negative. And it feels to me like like an expression of our Buddhist practice, that when we study ourselves and we study the world and we do so with compassion, of course we want to take action. We want to do something. And that action may have very, very different forms, some of which look like activism and some of which don't, or don't in the sort of narrow sense. I mean, I think, you know, thinking of people who I know and love who choose to study to be priests and to care for the Buddhist temples and make those temples a place of refuge for themselves and for others, to me, that's also socially engaged Buddhism, or that's also Buddhist action. And then there are those of us who feel moved to, you know, go to Colombia and to stand with the human rights defenders and the peace workers there, and to use our privilege and our beings to be with those other people and to make their work and their lives safer, and that feels like our Buddhist expression.
Some of the places that the Buddhist Peace Fellowship is engaged in activism are in Arizona with the immigration new law, fighting human trafficking in Malaysia, political prisoners in Myanmar, the oil spill in the Gulf. I was amazed at the many places that you are encouraging Buddhists to be involved. How do you come up with your list?
You know, I think it's a kind of combination between strategy and response. Strategy in the sense of we have some sense of what Buddhist Peace Fellowship has traditionally done and what our members and the Buddhist community is interested in. There's a kind of ongoing interest, for example, in the situation in Buddhist Asia, like, you know, freedom in Tibet and the situation of the monks in Burma. So there's that kind of choosing what we do. And then I think part of it is really response, is like we are known as a Buddhist activist organization, and many people reach out to us saying, come join our campaign, or come show up at our demonstration, or let's work together on this. And some people who are Buddhist and who want to see this Buddhist organization make a statement about a situation, and then other people who maybe aren't Buddhist but are wondering what the Buddhist perspective is. So I think that there's that balance between kind of careful choosing and prioritizing and strategizing, and then actually leaving some space and availability to respond. So I think, I mean, just recently here in Oakland, there was the verdict in the Oscar Grant trial, in which a white police officer killed a young black man in a BART station, in a public transportation station, and the verdict came out that the police officer committed involuntary manslaughter, and there's been a lot of pain and suffering here in Oakland, you know, in our home in Oakland, around that and around the systemic racism that continues to perpetuate such situations. So that's just, you know, that just happened a few days ago. And the question is coming into my inbox and coming up in my heart, really, of what is our response as a Buddhist organization who has our office and a lot of our members here in the Bay Area? What can we do to be with that pain and to make some kind of statement about that injustice? So I'm not sure yet what we're going to do, or in what form that will take. Definitely, we will, you know, have information about the trial and the verdict and the response of the people in Oakland. We'll put that kind of information on our website and in our e-newsletter, and use our other forms of publication, which is sometimes the most that we can do in terms of, you know, the many, many, many situations in the world that call our attention.
And again, the website for the Buddhist Peace Fellowship is bpf.org. B as in Buddhist, P as in peace, F as in fellowship, bpf.org. We have a caller waiting on line number one. Let's go to that caller. Yes, you're on the air with our guest, Sarah Weintraub.
Hello, Ms. Weintraub. Very much appreciate your work and the organization that you're involved in. Just a kind of a philosophical question. If at a deeper level of consciousness, there really are no distinctions, no dualisms, such as between just and unjust, moral and immoral, how do you make the case for social activism at the level of social action. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Could you hear the question?
I did, yes. Thank you for that question and for your support of our work. This is a familiar question, I think, in Buddhist communities or in Buddhist individuals of here we are saying that everything is part of the same thing and that it's all connected and that no one's to blame and no one's at fault. And yet, so then where's the justification for actually doing something? And I think the kind of Buddhist teaching for me that speaks to that the most and that kind of resonates with me the most, and I hope it's not too Buddhist-y for the many listeners, but I'll just try my best, is the idea of both, of holding both the absolute truth and the relative truth at the same time. And to me, that means the absolute truth is kind of the wider, the absolute, that we are all connected and that I only exist because everything else exists, and we're all bringing the current reality into existence at the same time. And you can't pick one piece out and say, you know, it's his fault, he's bad, because, well, what made him bad and what were the situations of his childhood and the childhood of his parents and, you know, et cetera. Pretty soon you're connected to everything. So I think there is that truth where we're not, where we can't separate out one element to attack, so to speak. And then I think there's also the relative truth, which is kind of what I was talking about earlier about looking around and kind of carefully observing our own selves and our own skills and abilities and interests and passions, and carefully observing the world and what's happening and what situations are happening. And then from there, from an understanding of the relative, the kind of day-to-day truth, the, you know, tangible, obvious, maybe obvious is not the right word, but the kind of more what you can see or what you can feel kind of truth, choosing to take action that is in accordance with ending suffering. And of course, we can't end suffering at the same time. You know, there's suffering is an element of human existence, and we can also. So that's the absolute again, that we can't end suffering, but then in a relative sense, we still it makes our lives meaningful to be working towards ending suffering, and we can have enormous positive impact in the relative world or in the relative reality. So that's a teaching that has been really helpful for me in understanding how to hold both of those, how to hold kind of the widest, most vast realm of interconnectedness and interdependence and impermanence, that it's all changing anyway, and then also how to kind of keep grounded, keep our feet on the ground, and keep connecting to the situations of suffering that humans and animals and the planet are in, and to do something in relation to those.
Let me reintroduce our guest for those who may have joined Keeping the Faith later today. Sarah Weintraub is the executive director of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. We're talking with her by phone today in Oakland, California. Sarah has spent 7 years in Colombia as part of a program in solidarity with folks suffering there from the war situation. She spent time in a Zen monastery in San Francisco after that, and has very recently been selected as the executive director of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. Sarah, where did you go to school?
I went to a program of Long Island University, which was called at the time the Friends World Program. Friends as in the Quaker sense of friends. It's now called Global Studies Program or something like that, and it's kind of an independent entity within Long Island University. Which actually offered and continues to offer its students the opportunity to study in different countries. There are campuses all over the world, and you're actually required to study at least two outside of your home country. And the learning is also very experiential based, with a lot of independent study and internships and that kind of a curriculum.
And was it that program that sent you to Central America before you went to Colombia?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah, I studied in Costa Rica and in Nicaragua through that program.
Wow. And where had you learned Spanish?
I started studying Spanish as a child in elementary school, but then I really learned the summer after my sophomore year of high school. I spent that summer in Ecuador with a volunteer program called Amigos de las Americas, which placed teenagers, mostly 16 and up, in rural communities to do kind of Peace Corps type work for the summer. So I did that for that summer when I was 16, and that was when I really got solid with my Spanish. And then I spent some time in Mexico after I graduated from college, and then that year in Central America. But I still had a lot to learn when I got to Colombia, for sure.
So you were starting your activist life as a sophomore in high school.
Yeah, pretty much.
And were you encouraged to do that by your parents?
Yeah. Let's see. I think, it wasn't like they didn't particularly tell me to or anything, but they were extremely supportive. The program Amigos de las Americas, part of it is that you have to fundraise a big percentage of the cost of your going. And there's various fundraisers that they organize to help you do that. And my parents really helped me and do those fundraisers and were, yeah, extremely supportive of me. It was my idea and it was my dream, but they absolutely supported it every step of the way.
We're about halfway through our interview today with Sarah Weintraub. We'll be getting back to her in just a moment, but let me tell listeners again, if you've missed part of this program or would like to hear previous programs of Keeping the Faith, you may go to will.illinois.edu/AM. When you get the option between AM, FM, and TV, go to AM, and then you can go to Keeping the Faith, and you'll see all of our programs listed, or you may put her name or Buddhist Peace Fellowship in the search engine, and this program will pop up, and you can listen to it or any of our other programs at your convenience. Next week, as I mentioned earlier, we'll be talking with Maureen Holtz, who is a co-author of the book Robert Allerton, The Private Man, The Public Gifts. It's all about his personal life, his interest in the arts, and his philanthropy. He was one of the major donors, for example, to the Art Institute in Chicago. Gave a major gift to the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign of Allerton, what has become Allerton Park, his former home, mansion, and grounds. Our guest July 25th here on Keeping the Faith will be Harry Strong. We're titling that program Faces of Faith, Walking Off the Pages of the Bible. Harry Strong is widely known for presenting characters from the Bible, both the Hebrew Scriptures and the Christian New Testament, often minor characters, but who see interesting biblical events. So we'll be talking with Harry Strong about how he creates those characters, and a little bit of an insight into some of the specific ones that he has presented. Later in August, we'll be speaking with Dean Craig Jessup, the former director of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. He recently moved on from that position and went to Utah State University, where he's a professor of music and then head of the music department and now dean of the College of the Arts. And we'll be talking about his faith. He's a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, often called Mormons. So we'll be talking about his faith in relation to music and the arts. So that'll be August 15th. Should be an interesting conversation with Dean Craig Jessup. Well, let's get back to our guest, Sarah Weintraub, who's the executive director of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. Tell us about the fellowships. We went down that list of various things you're involved with and trying to encourage people. How many people respond to your calls, your emails, your newsletters to actually do something?
Yeah, well, we don't keep track of that specifically. I think it's kind of a general sense of things. Our our magazine goes out to about, the magazine we publish, Turning Wheel Magazine, goes out to about 2,500 people, as well as a number of centers, you know, Dharma centers that then many people may read it. And our e-newsletter goes out to about 5,000 people. I think when we send out a call for action, we don't necessarily, we often get a lot of response of people saying, thank you for letting me know about this, or, you know, this is very interesting, have you seen this, you know, that kind of thing. But it's kind of more in an informal sense.
And when you hear back from folks, do they, yours is an organization that's supported by donations, is that correct?
Yes.
So you must have people who appreciate what you're doing and
who
make contributions.
Yes, and we appreciate what they do too.
Sure.
Yeah, so that is another way to think about what kind of response we get, is that we are completely funded by donations, and most of them, the vast majority, small donations, you know, $100 a year, $50 a year. Our kind of entry-level membership fee is $45 a year for people to join us as members. So that is a kind of wide group of people who are moved by what we're doing and support it with their financial capital.
And are your supporters almost entirely from the U.S., or is it more broadly supported?
They are mostly from the U.S. We have about maybe 200 members internationally, including some affiliated groups in other countries. But we're pretty national organization.
Have you traveled yet in Asia?
Not as part of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. I have been to Asia on two occasions. I taught English in Nepal when I was 18. I was there for a few months, and then I recently visited my little brother, who was living in China, actually teaching English, and I visited him there.
Let me give the phone numbers for our listeners who might like to join this conversation in Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Elsewhere, a toll-free call, 1-800-222-9455. Sarah, when you were, let's see, in Nepal and then in Central America, culture shock?
Definitely, yeah. I think I was very moved by traveling. I really wanted to travel as a teenager and as a, you know, young person, really. That was kind of all I wanted to do. I was so interested. And, yeah, a big part of it was kind of the shock of different worlds and being immersed in new ways of living. And then I feel like that kind of wanting to travel, which I remember from being a child, really, kind of as long as I can remember, shifted at a certain point, actually when I was in Nicaragua, through some of the work that I was doing there, actually shifted to wanting to do something or be a part of something and not just travel but actually live there and actually be useful, be helpful. So that feels like very kind of innate to me, or very natural, that kind of wanting to travel that then shifted in this way. And it's what I've been doing as long as I've had a choice about it. It's been, you know, particularly living in other countries, but also trying to do something that feels helpful, whether in other countries or here.
Earlier, when you were describing your experience in Colombia, you described it as non-interventionist, solidarity, accompanying the people who were accused of crimes, who had perhaps been convicted of crimes, or who were suffering from the wars. Tell us about that experience. What was that 7 years like?
Yeah, well, not. I wasn't accompanying people who had been accused of crimes or convicted of crimes. I was accompanying people who were working for peace and defending human rights, so working for peace and human rights.
Ah, I misunderstood. Sorry.
Yeah, no. Specifically, I worked most closely with a peace community, which is the peace community of San Jose de Apartado in northwestern Colombia, and they are a group of rural farmers who, you know, grow a lot of their own food and also grow some bananas and some chocolate beans for export. and they live in an area that's very, very highly contested and very strategic for the civil war in Colombia. The civil war between the military, the Colombian military, and their paramilitary death squads, who they work closely with. And on the other side, the insurgency, the guerrilla groups who are also very corrupt, who've been around for many, many, many years and have lost most of their kind of leftist ideology that they started out with. And it's pretty much a war for power and for land and money at this point. And the peace community that I worked with, their little bit of land is kind of right in the middle of two areas that are controlled by those opposing forces. And so their land is very strategic. It's also very fertile for growing whatever. So what often happens in that kind of area is that the land is taken over by one side and the farmers are forced to kind of support that in that force through, you know, giving them food or giving them information or whatever. And then the land is taken over by the other side and the civilians, the farmers, are then punished for having supported the other side, which they were forced to do. So the peace community refuses to take sides, refuses to carry weapons, refuses to pass on any information, and they are organized in groups, and they work together in groups. So that's a little bit about the peace community and the background there. And what we did, and what the Fellowship of Reconciliation Colombia Peace Presence continues to do, is to be present in the settlements of the peace community to prevent them from being attacked, really. Both sides, there's very much the logic of if you're not with us, you're against us from both sides. So you may say you're a peace community, but really you're the enemy is kind of the way that that both sides of the conflict relate to people who are working for peace. And furthermore, people who are working for peace or for human rights are particularly targeted by the government paramilitary side of things because those activities are considered to be leftist and thus somehow connected to the guerrilla, which is not true. There's actually an incredibly diverse and vibrant movement for peace in Colombia with indigenous groups and youth groups and women and electoral work and rural farmers and many, many others. So the way that accompaniment works in this particular model of accompaniment or this strategy is that there's both a physical presence and a political presence. So part of that is to actually be physically living in the settlement with the community members and basically saying with our presence, if something happens here, if these people are attacked, it will be big news in the international community. We'll make a big fuss, and it won't be worth it. It won't be worth it for your image, you know, saying that to both sides of the conflict. And in Colombia, both sides of the conflict actually care about their international image, which is why accompaniment works. In other situations and in other conflicts, that may not be the case, and they may not care. But in Colombia, the government wants to be seen as a legitimate government, and the Colombian government receives huge amounts of aid from the U.S. government, so they need to at least maintain the appearance of, you know, that they're caring for human rights. They try to maintain that appearance. And likewise, the guerrilla want to be seen as a legitimate insurgency force rather than as a kind of bandit group. So both sides care about their image, and both don't want the international, you know, the foreign presence to make that kind of big fuss. And so when we're there while we're there physically, we're actually representing, you know, not just me, Sarah, a little American, but representing thousands of concerned Americans who, the idea being, who will, if we ask them to, call their congresspeople, call the U.S. Embassy, and, you know, make a big deal if something were to happen to these people who we are accompanying. So to back up the physical presence is a whole lot of political work with the diplomatic corps and Congress people and the grassroots communities, kind of educating the U.S. Grassroots community what's going on in Colombia, and then a lot of analysis of the situation. The part of the political work is analysis of what's going on, what might happen next. Is accompaniment still effective? Is it still safe for the people who are working there? because if I'm not safe, then not only am I not safe, but I'm not effective either. I'm not protecting anyone if I'm not safe myself. So I was very involved in both the physical and the political side of the accompaniment work for the 3 years that I lived in Colombia. And then for the years after that, I've continued being involved, going back and helping out and kind of filling in and training people and going on speaking tour for the grassroots education side of things. And then I've also been involved in other ways, like we are actually through BPF and through some other support, we are working on a film about youth resistance to the war in Colombia. The film is called Dar Papaya Project, and we did all the filming last year, and we're in the editing process now, and the film is about American youth and Colombian youth and their work for against war and for nonviolence in the various situations that they're coming from, including kids who've grown up in gang-filled areas in, you know, San Francisco, and then kids who've grown up in paramilitary-filled areas in the barrios of Medellin, Colombia. So there's kind of contrasting, but also just exploring the responses of these young people and the incredible work that they're doing.
Sarah, is this film a documentary?
It's a documentary, yes. Yes, it's a documentary.
Spell the name for us again, please.
It's Dar Papaya Project. That's D-A-R space P-A-P-A-Y-A Project.
All right.
Yeah. And
that will be out, you hope, within a year?
Oh, we hope so. It may take a little longer than that. As documentaries go, we're kind of, you know, trying to squeeze out little bits of time to work on it, but it's a slow process of editing.
And let me guess, you're raising money as you go.
Absolutely, yes, and using a lot of our own money and our, you know, friends and family, our generous friends and family help.
Independent films.
Yeah, but it is now one of the collaborative projects that the Buddhist Peace Fellowship is also involved with. And involved in supporting and publicizing. So that's been exciting to bring those things together.
We're down to our last 12 or 13 minutes with our guest today on Keeping the Faith, Sarah Weintraub. Let me give the phone numbers again if listeners have a question or would like to make a comment. 333-9455 in the 217 area code. If it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455. Sarah, you were talking about earlier temples and monasteries and Buddhist centers as being places of refuge. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, I think of it in a few ways. I think that there's the actual kind of physical feeling of refuge, you know, thinking about me coming out of Colombia, where I was living in this war zone in northwestern Colombia, and then was living in the very exciting city of Bogota, the capital, and then going to the Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, which is totally out in the middle of nowhere. You have to take a dirt road to get there and is so safe and quiet and beautiful. So I think there's a real physical feeling of refuge, of safety, of someplace you can come and actually kind of exhale and relax and be okay and actually be okay in the world and be safe in the world, and that's a very healing experience. Tassajara is also a hot springs. There's a hot springs there that's been there for many, many years, and it's an old sacred place to the native Esalen indigenous tribe. So there's kind of a lot of healing going on there. And then I think actually the other, Even if you're in a temple or a monastery that's not so physically far removed from daily life, I think my meditation space in my house, or just sitting down to kind of take that time and that space for myself and for being with myself has an aspect of refuge to it. There's a kind of talk about finding refuge or finding a home in your own breath and in your own body. And so that kind of feeling that kind of traditional Zen training has really helped me find that that space of refuge and quiet just within my own self, which then, you know, I don't have to go to Tal Sahara. I have it wherever I am. And, of course, I still love to go to Tal Sahara.
It happens, Sarah, that just last week we replayed a program because I was traveling out of state that was an interview with a professor in a Christian seminary, a Union Theological Seminary in New York City, who has just written a book that's gotten a lot of press called I Could Not Be a Christian Without Being a Buddhist. Maybe you know of Paul Knitter, K-N-I-T-T-E-R, his most recent book. Is that something that's common, that people appreciate Buddhism and indulge in, maybe that's not the right word, but practice Buddhism and yet call themselves a Jew or call themselves a Christian or call themselves a Muslim?
Actually, I have seen that a lot. I think that Buddhism can kind of lend itself to taking on various forms, or, you know, people can kind of take from it what is useful to them, you know, meditation practice or some other practice. They can take from it and kind of incorporate it into their spiritual practice that is that's already going on for them, or kind of come up with some sort of blend. I think there isn't a lot of clashing. I'm just thinking, actually, my parents are both of Jewish ancestry, as am I, of Jewish ancestry, and we went to every year to a Buddhist Passover celebration of some other friends who also, you know, were practicing Buddhists and totally devoted to that way of life, but wanted to continue to honor their traditions that they had grown up with and their culture and their other backgrounds. So I think that happens often and naturally, and for other people not. You know, for other people, they really, I think people can take on Buddhism as a religion, and they can also take it on as a spiritual practice, and there doesn't really seem to be any conflict or problem in that.
You say on your website that peace is your middle name, Buddhist Peace Fellowship. Let's talk a little bit about peace. Are you personally a pacifist? Like before you went to Colombia, where you knew you might be involved in violence, there might be violence around you, did you determine in advance that you would not respond in any physically violent way?
You know, that line, peace is our middle name, it just came out of my mouth one day. I wasn't even thinking about it. And then I was like, well, that's kind of cheesy, but people liked it, so I put it up. So I think in terms of how peace relates to our work, I think, you know, I don't know if I would say I'm exactly a pacifist. Nor would I say I'm not, but I do know before going to Colombia, definitely one of the commitments that I made was to act nonviolently, to use the strategy of nonviolence, and that actually, because of my particular background, is pretty easy for me and pretty natural for me. I think people in other situations, you know, exposed to other kinds of pressures and history and other things, that's much more of a challenge. I'm very fortunate that felt pretty natural to me, but I think that it's hard to say. Actually, we do this exercise with people who were training to go to Colombia, which is a nonviolence barometer where we give them certain situations and then they have to place themselves kind of on a spectrum of whether they think it's violent or not violent. And it can be very illuminating because you think it's so obvious, right? But then actually when people do this, people have enormously different interpretations. For example, I was just in a training and we offered the situation for the nonviolence barometer, which was accompanying a community leader who is known to beat his wife. And that was really tricky for people, you know. Is it violent to accompany him because then you're allowing him to continue his violent actions? Or is it violent to not accompany him because then as a community leader he may be killed, you know? So I think there's a huge range in people's interpretation of those ideas, but I think for me, I'm committed to nonviolence and to working for peace, and to actually continuing to learn what those things mean and continuing to try to understand what other people's perspectives on those things may be. But yes, I guess in general I would say I'm a pacifist.
Sarah, on a radio broadcast and on an online broadcast, of course we can't have much silence or people will think we've disappeared and punch a button and listen to something else. But could you give us a little introduction to Buddhist meditation without having too much silence?
Without stopping talking. Sure. Well, there's many kinds of Buddhist meditation, but the kind that I'm most familiar with, the Soto Zen type of Buddhist meditation, is called Shikantaza, which means just sitting. And the kind of very basics of that is to find a kind of quiet place and to settle yourself in a comfortable position, often a seated position, and to give some care to arranging your position so that you feel stable and balanced and your back is upright, your vertebrae are stacked on top of each other, kind of in a way that's upright and but comfortable and relaxed, and to let your gaze kind of drift downwards, sort of like at a 45-degree angle, sort of gazing downwards. So you're in this relaxed but open, stable position. And then often what people are encouraged to do is to follow the movement of their breath. So not to force it or to change it or to push it, but just to be aware of it, actually, to kind of, we have to be aware of something. So to kind of rest your awareness on the movement of your breath and how the air comes in and our bellies and chest fill up and then the air goes out and we can maybe feel the exhale on our upper lip. So we can just kind of gently rest our attention there and sit quietly for a while. And what you may find, what most people find, is that we can't stay focused on our breath for very long, maybe for one or two breaths. And then other thoughts start coming in, and daydreams and fears and anxieties. And the kind of idea around that is that we're not, we don't push those things out of our mind. Like, I don't want to think about that. I'm trying to meditate right now. Nor do we let ourselves wander away with them and like, oh, what should I make for breakfast? And it's been a long time since I've made pancakes or, you know, whatever. But to actually let the thought come and then let it go, like clouds drifting by is the kind of the way that that's often put. So I think that's kind of like the the most basic few-minute version of a Soto Zen meditation instruction is basically sit quietly and comfortably and let your thoughts drift in and out. And if you notice yourself wandering away with a thought, then you can catch it and you can gently come back to your breath and come back to or to focusing on your posture or to noticing, you know, how your legs feel against the floor or which are ways of really bringing us back to right now and to awareness of right here, right now, you know, the present moment. And, yeah.
In many parts of the world where Buddhism is the majority religion, there is conflict with, and has been over the centuries, with Islam more than with any other faith. Islam has very definite understandings. A good Muslim is to pray five times a day, is to take a pilgrimage, and so on, give dues. Is Buddhism just loosey-goosey, or is a good Buddhist to practice meditation daily or more than once daily? What are the expectations?
Yeah,
are there any?
Well, I think the expectation is kind of like to live a good life and to be kind to other beings. There definitely isn't an expectation for meditation. Meditation is really has a lot of focus in terms of Western Buddhism, or particularly people who've converted to Buddhism, and meditation as a practice, as a spiritual practice. But there are many, many, many people who relate to their Buddhist practice in other ways. And it's like what you do and you go to see the Buddhist priest for your marriage ceremony or for your funeral ceremony, but not for not in terms of like a daily practice. There are many other forms. People may make offerings or visit temples or donate to temples as part of their practice of supporting that life. So I think it's extremely wide the way that Buddhism can be interpreted, and actually very Buddhism over the many years has kind of lived comfortably in various cultures. You know, it started in India, and then some traveled to various places, but some Buddhism traveled to China and eventually to Japan. And you know, the tradition that I was trained in that's the lineage, you know, from India to China to Japan to the U.S. And in each of those cultures, it really took on a completely different flavor. You know, in India, there were more kind of wandering monks who wandered and begged and then came together during the rainy season to live together and be in one place and then would go off wandering again. And when Buddhism moved to China, there were very different understandings of begging and different understandings of living in community, and there was much more of a value on work. And the monks would live together and would work, and they would cook their own food and, you know, that kind of thing. So the Buddhism has, to some extent, taken on some of the characteristics of the culture in which it's found itself. And I think we're still in the early phases of Buddhism being in the U.S., actually. Early, speaking of the thousands of years of history of Buddhism, it's still pretty early here. So I think we're not totally sure what it's going to look like.
Sarah, we're down to our last 60 seconds with you. Tell listeners how they may contact you if they have other questions.
Yeah, definitely. Well, my email address, which you can also find on our website, is Sarah, S-A-R-A-H, at BPF, for Buddhist Peace Fellowship.org. And also, please check out our website, sign up for our e-newsletter, and I would love to hear from you all.
And if people don't have access to computers, is there a phone number?
Sure. Yeah. Our phone number here in Oakland is 510-655-6169.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Sarah Weintraub, that's spelled Weintraub, who is the executive director of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. Again, that website is bpf.org. That's B as in Buddhist, P as in peace, and F as in fellowship. I want to thank Sarah for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much.
Next week here on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with Maureen Holtz, who is a co-author of the new book, Robert Allerton, The Private Man and the Public Gifts. On July 25th, our guest will be by phone, Harry Strong. We'll be talking about Faces of Faith, walking off the pages of the Bible, some of the very interesting biblical characters. Later in August, Dean Craig Jessup will be our guest, former director of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, talking about the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints in relation to music. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Thank you for listening.